as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions that you would like us to take at the end of the call, please email them to David_Lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at HancockBank.com. Let's go ahead and introduce the speakers. I have, as always, John Porwood, our Chief Investment Officer, David Lundgren, Director of Equities and Research, and Jeffrey Tangus, Director of Fixed Income. Dave, I'll go ahead and pass the call to you.
Thank you, Ashley, and thank you, everyone, once again for joining us. John, I guess the big news of the week and possibly of the year is the death of Osama bin Laden. Is there any market or economic impact by this event?
Well, I guess perhaps briefly, yesterday there was a little bit of enthusiasm in the market that some people tried to trace back to the death of bin Laden, but obviously there really shouldn't be, you know, any particular impact by that. I guess going forward and looking long term, some of the people who like to pontificate about these things have suggested that his death may be a signal that, you know, Al-Qaeda really is diminished in relative power, and that, you know, this could be, I guess, a confirmation that perhaps we have passed a turning point, but all that is just conjecture. So, you know, basically, as far as we're concerned, from an investment standpoint, it's nothing.
Okay, thank you. Oil and gas prices continue to make headlines. Gasoline prices moved even closer to $4 per gallon last week, which is the highest since July of 2008. Will consumers and businesses get any relief soon, and what is the impact?
A few weeks ago, or I guess maybe a few months ago, there were some thoughts that relief might be coming fairly soon on the energy front and perhaps for gas prices. But lately, it looks like any momentum in that direction has sort of disappeared. The last time we looked at figures based on estimates concerning what would happen to GDP if oil prices stayed high, the indication was that if oil prices stayed above $100 a barrel for a year, it would impact GDP growth, you know, maybe 50 basis points, maybe more. You know, unless we really get some diminution in growth on the economic front, it looks like oil prices might stay higher than anybody would have liked for a while. So chances are the higher oil prices generally and higher gas prices may be with us longer than we had originally thought. So...
Okay, thanks. I guess on the last several calls that we've had, we've talked about a stronger economy and how the economy was transitioning from recovery to expansion. It seems, though, we've hit a soft patch now, and some of the evidence around that. Initial jobless claims last Thursday, came in at 429,000. That was the highest in 3 months, and it was the third consecutive reading above 400,000. Nominal GDP for the first quarter was just 3.9%, with real GDP at a lower than expected 1.8%. And home prices continue to struggle. The most recent Case-Shiller Index of Property Values reading was down 3.3% on a year-over-year basis and was very near a six-year low. Are you concerned, first of all, and do you see this soft patch continuing, or is this just a blip?
Let's look at the near-term data first. There are two indicators of economic activity that we might call real-time indicators. One is produced by the Chicago Fed. It's the Chicago National Activity Index. There's another produced by the Philadelphia Fed called the Diebold-Scotty or Diebold-Scotty Economic Index. Both of those suggest that current economic activity is a little bit above average, indicating, as some economists have forecast recently, that the second quarter is going to be better than the first quarter. And so to some degree, the first quarter probably was a blip. Some of it was weather-related. There was a big fall-off in government spending that had a lot to do with it. But if you go back to the beginning of time, I guess, as far as this cycle is concerned, and look at Reinhardt and Rogoff's research concerning the aftermath of a really big credit bubble like the one we've just had, it takes anywhere from 5 to 10 years. I think their long-term look back at history was something like 5 to 7 or 5 to 8 years to work out of this. So the idea that we're in a below average in terms of 3% being average GDP growth environment for a good while is probably pretty normal, and we have sort of always taken that position that we were in a below average GDP growth environment. It looks like this year, if we're fortunate, it's going to be roughly like last year, which was about 2.7% on average. And our guess is that, you know, or our guess a few months ago was that it would probably be something like that this year. And unless we get some 4 to 5% GDP quarters going forward, which looks highly unlikely, this year is going to be also a below average year in terms of GDP growth. But nevertheless, if you look at the various leading indicators and currently what's happening now from those two coincident indicators I mentioned, there's no indication that we're about to slip back into recession. So it's just a slow growth period, as you might imagine would be the case for a number of years following, you know, the problem that we had back in 08.
Well, I guess the good news is, despite the softness in the economy, the market continues to steam ahead. April, the S&P 500 finished up 3% for the month, bringing the 2011 total to almost 9.1%. That makes 7 consecutive months for the S&P 500 with positive returns. And so far, the first quarter earnings have been good. They are tracked to increase 17% on a year-over-year basis, with revenues increasing at about a 13% year-over-year pace. How long does this continue, John? 7 months in a row?
Normally, if you look back again at the history of the market, coming off of a fairly severe bear market low, you would expect a rally in the general market, looking at the market indices, anywhere from 50 to 70%. Well, we've had about 95%, I think, if I remember the last number correctly, which puts it in a relatively small group of events like this going back in history. It looks a little bit like what happened after the 73-74 decline, and you had a huge rally into 1975 before you went into another, you know, long consolidation. Probably we're at that point now where we've probably seen the market rally about as much as it's going to in a straight line, more or less, from the low, and it's going to be slower going for the major indices going forward. The problem you have is that profit margins are very high, and profit margins have a history of mean reversion. So if we get any kind of mean reversion at this point, since profit margins are about as high as they ever have been historically, you know, that suggests perhaps, you know, slower earnings growth going forward. Sales growth recently is about 14 or 15%. There is a projection this year for another 14 or 15% increase in sales growth. However, if you look back at sales growth historically, it also demonstrates a mean reversion or cyclicality, which suggests that, you know, expecting the same amount of sales growth this year that we had last year is probably a little bit unrealistic. So the market itself, from a valuation standpoint, is not terribly expensive, but it's not particularly cheap in a shorter-term sense anyway. If you look at it in a longer-term sense, the market's fairly expensive using some long-term valuation measures. So after this 95% run off the bottom, we would expect that, you know, it's time for more consolidation and perhaps, you know, more of a struggle for the major indices. And hopefully, if history is any guide, during this period where, you know, you're not necessarily bearish, but you're at the tail end, let's say, or the second stage of a bull move, the market gets more discriminating and people begin to look more at relative value and it becomes more of a stock-picking environment rather, you know, than a everything moves the same kind of environment. So, again, it looks like we're not on the verge of a new bear market anytime real soon. But in terms of the market continuing to make the kind of gains it's made in the past, probably a little optimistic to think that's going to happen.
Okay, great. Jeff Tangus, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Not often that S&P credit outlook statements make major headlines, but a couple weeks ago, the United States of America's credit rating was put on watch with a negative outlook. And to quote Standard & Poor's, they put the U.S. government on notice that it risks losing its AAA credit rating unless policymakers agree on a plan by 2013 to reduce budget deficits and the national debt. Is this real, or is this some type of political statement, or is the U.S. truly in jeopardy of losing its AAA rating?
Well, I think the first answer to your question is it is real, in that everyone knows that we're the U.S. is on an unsustainable trajectory. So in that sense, and in looking at S&P's release, they did not give us any new information. There was no new data in their release. What they're doing is basically saying, well, they're trying to regain some credibility after the last credit crunch, 2008. They lost a lot of credibility, and I think everyone looks at S&P and says, are they going to be for real this time? And I think that's what part of this is them trying to regain some credibility. But you can't ignore the fact that they're right. Putting the U.S. on credit watch is basically doing just what you said. It's saying that the U.S. needs to come up with a plan in the next couple years, a credible plan that's agreed to by both parties, and the plan has to have some reasonable chance of success. I thought it was interesting. S&P said there's a 1 in 3 chance that the rating will be cut in the next 2 years. That's a pretty significant those are pretty significant odds when you think they're talking about the credit quality of the United States. So what they're saying is that this is not something that they take lightly, and it's not something to be ignored. But also, it's not something that's without precedent. Actually, not S&P, but Fitch had put the U.S. on watch back in 95 and 96 when Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton got into a shouting match over the budget, and they shut the government down, and the rating agencies definitely didn't like that. So while we think this is real big news, in reality, it's happened in fairly recent history. So I think this is just a shot across the bow of the administration and certainly the Republicans, but they need to get serious about this. Moody's has not changed their opinion. They're still at stable. They think that it's a positive thing that we're at least talking about it in a serious fashion now. So they're focusing more on that aspect of it all. And that there's really another step beyond putting somebody on negative outlook. Then you go to a watch, negative watch, which is another step up in seriousness, and they're not there right now. It's just the outlook is negative. So there's a couple steps to go before they even can seriously consider a downgrade, but it is an important first step. The offset to all that is that around the world, the U.S. is still really the only place that countries and extremely large investors can put money. So Europe's not an alternative right now with the problems that they're having with all the Greeces and the Ireland. So the U.S. has in its favor the fact that it is still the reserve currency of the world, and that, in reality, the Republicans and the Democrats aren't that far apart on their deficit reduction program. They're both agreeing on the same number, about $4 trillion. It's just a question of timing as to whether it takes place over 10 years or 12 years. And S&P actually did not mention the debt ceiling, the amount of debt that the U.S. is borrowing, only the fact that they're running up huge deficits every year. So that was also a telling aspect to it all. So at the end of the day, it wasn't really anything new, but it was S&P really trying to maintain their credibility as a watchdog of creditworthiness.
Okay. Let's talk about interest rates for a moment. April, I guess, was the first month in quite a while where we've seen a fairly significant decline. 3-year dropped 30 basis points to just below 1%. The 5-year Treasury dropped 30 basis points also to slightly below 2%. and the 10-year dropped 18 basis points to 3.3%. In the face of rising commodity prices that we've talked about for the last few months, and all the talk about inflation in general, it seems to be a little bit of a surprise.
It is certainly, the market always does what it needs to do to confound the most people most of the time, and this would fall into that category. We had a couple things happened in the last month that I think are important in terms of interest rates. Very short-term interest rates, overnight rates, repo rates collapsed in the last month. They were low to begin with, but they have they've gone to almost zero now, a function of the FDIC changing the way that they fee banks, and that's caused demand for repo to drop significantly. So we've seen very short-term overnight rates drop. And the short end, of course, as you mentioned, is down, the 2-year and the 3-year and the 10-year down also. So all those, I think that's also a reflection of what John touched on, which is the soft patch. I think everyone was a little optimistic on the strength in the economy. We're starting to see forecasts for the coming quarters and for the year ratcheting down now, and that's manifesting itself as in lower interest rates, especially in the Treasury market. And then also the aspect of what's going on in Greece and Ireland, the fact that the pigs are having trouble again, and that Greece is looking more and more like it will need some sort of restructuring. There's a flight to quality in the dollar there, which is helping support Treasury yields. And then most recently, just the last couple of days, the attack on Osama bin Laden has created a little buying pressure in longer-term treasuries because of the anticipation that there may be a follow-up terrorist event that will create a flight to quality there as well. So there's been a lot going on all over the short, intermediate, and long-term part of the markets on the taxable side, all of which has forced rates significantly lower, as you said, over the past 30 days. And then outside of the taxable arena, on the municipal front, the scare of last fall and early 2011 continues to dissipate. And so, for example, the Bond Buyer 40 yield, which is a long-term index, is down from about 5.72% early in the month to 5.5%. So it's down about 20 basis points as well. Another indication that some normalcy is returning to the municipal markets also.
Oh, let me mention one other thing, Jeff, just to elaborate just briefly on your comment about interest rates and inflation. The general forecast has been for higher inflation and higher interest rates almost consistently for the last decade or more. Maybe that's always been the case ever since the inflationary period of the 1970s, but it really hasn't happened. And one thing I think we all need to think about going forward as we contemplate the possibility, of course, there's always that possibility that inflation could run out of control at some point in the future. It's much more difficult to get inflation started if you're in a highly indebted environment. And we got a lot of high debt. Europe has a lot of debt. Maybe it can be generated in the emerging economies, but in a simple way, it's much harder for somebody to run fast if they got an anvil of debt tied around their waist, as far as our economy is concerned. So, unless the developed countries of the world and the Fed and the central banks around the world, start throwing money out of helicopters for us to pick it up off the ground, it's highly likely, I think, that inflation will remain relatively low compared to what certain expectations are. It may be, higher than anybody would like, but the idea of inflation running away anytime soon seems like unlikely, I guess, at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff and John. That concludes our prepared questions. We do have a couple of questions that have been sent in, and if you have questions, please email them to me, David_Lundgren, LUNDGREN, at HancockBank.com. And the first couple of questions we got were both specific asset class questions outlook, munis and silver. So if you can address both of those, and Jeff, feel free to chime in on the question as well.
Yeah, that's a very interesting combination. Anybody who's been following silver recently probably recognizes that it is just about to approach or is already in the mania stage. Rumors are already swirling about the world running out of silver. This has happened before. We've gotten some feedback from some of our clients that they're being approached by people selling silver with all sorts of stories and rumors about, you know, the lack of silver in the world. Ned Davis recently published a five-page report that pretty well debunked that, and of course this type of thing is always comes out periodically when an economy, or rather a commodity, begins to accelerate and the speculators really, or a lot of speculation has really taken hold. In fact, as far as commodities in general are concerned, we're probably in the latter stages of a relatively long cycle that began 7 or 8 years ago, given some of the research that we see. And relatively speaking, probably municipal bonds are a better buy now than commodities and silver, in my opinion. Now, you know, you can buy an intermediate to long-term muni. Your yield is probably 4%. If you're in a 35% tax bracket, what's that, about a 7%, 6.5%, 7% after-tax yield? I don't know what's going to happen to silver or some of the other commodities, but my guess is that when they break, they'll break badly. And from a risk-return standpoint over the next couple of years, my guess is that munis are a better buy for what it's worth.
Jeff, anything you want to add to that on the muni side or silver side?
Well, I certainly agree. I don't have much comment on the silver. John knows a lot more about that than I could ever hope to add to. But on the muni side, we are just seeing more and more evidence. I saw a report yesterday. I don't remember exactly where it came from, if it was S&P or Moody's or Fitch. But the report basically said that they were looking for defaults, municipal defaults this year to be lower than last year. And last year was not a particularly bad year for defaults anyway. So, I mean, it's all still infinitesimal in terms of the amount as a percent of outstanding municipal debt, you know, something way under 1%, and most of that being in the non-rated, non-essential type service municipal bonds. But the tone of the article was that the forecast by Meredith Whitney and others in the latter part of last year calling for a municipal Armageddon this year just is not going to happen. I think she's going to end up with a lot of egg on her face there. And that you're seeing, as I indicated before, more and more buyers coming back into the municipal market realizing that, okay, maybe there will be some selected defaults out there and some second and third tier, but in terms of main issuers and well-followed issues, they make a very attractive investment considering all the other alternatives out there on an after-tax basis.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. John, this next question is asking for you to elaborate a little bit in regards to inflation from a historical perspective. The question is, what was the highest inflation rate that we reached in the 70s in the U.S.? And the question, go on to say, is there no danger of approaching that level in the next 5 to 10 years?
Let me think. It was in the 1970s, it was in the double digits. It was certainly north of 10%. I'm going to guess and say 12, 13, perhaps at its highest recorded point. That may be a little low. It might have actually been at one point a little bit higher than that. But that was driven by an inflationary environment that had its roots back in the late 60s and the early 70s. And that was a time when the money supply was expanding at a very rapid rate, and the policy of the Federal Reserve and the policy of the federal government at the time was to generate some inflation with the thought that it would minimize recessions and maintain a high level of employment. And once the inflation psychology took hold after that particular practice was in effect, everybody was playing the game. You know, wage increases were you know, made to try to keep everybody in line with inflation. The money supply was pumped up, and the cycle was just generating this self-feeding inflationary trend that eventually became, you know, damaging to the economy, and Paul Volcker had to step in to stop it. Now we've got, and of course, you know, the Fed was easy at the time. Well, now we've got a Fed that's certainly easy. The Fed's balance sheet, the excess reserves have expanded at, what, $2.7 trillion? Something like that. I can't remember what it is, but it's unprecedented on the books of the Fed. Excess reserves are huge, but nobody's really borrowing the money, relatively speaking. You know, the spending, borrowing, and lending cycle that you would normally expect to begin after a severe recession has not started at all. So unless that begins, and unless people begin to borrow and spend in a manner of the 1970s, repeating that event is probably not likely. Now, not in the next several years anyway. Now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you know, who knows exactly how this might develop. But we're going to take it, you know, a stage at a time. If we thought inflation was really going to be a big deal, and interest rates were going to rise enormously, then we'd buy a whole lot shorter bonds, wouldn't we?
Sure, we'd load up on TIPS and short bonds.
Yeah, we'd have TIPS and short bonds, you know, rather than what we currently own. So the indicators at the moment do not suggest we're about to enter a high inflationary period. However, we could have an inflationary period where the CPI, let's say, is 3%. And real GDP growth is relatively low, or nominal GDP growth is relatively low. So you could have a kind of replay of the massive stagflation of the 1970s, but just at a lower level, where inflation is just a little bit too high, you know, given what's really happening to economic growth. But in terms of runaway inflation like we had years ago, that doesn't seem to be in the cards, unless, as I said, the Federal Reserve starts throwing money out of helicopters on the ground for us to pick up, where we don't have to borrow any money to spend it. We can just go out and find it on the street. So unless that happens, we seem to be some distance away from a inflationary event like we had back in the 70s.
All right. We have a couple more questions. Given the high U.S. debt, do we realistically see the Fed raising rates in the next 12 months?
Based on Bernanke's last comments and the evidence from what's happening in the economy, it's probably unlikely that the Fed's going to raise interest rates in the near term. So, you know, we're out into next year or maybe some indefinite time before that happens. If the economic recovery stays moderate and unemployment continues to improve only slowly as we have currently seen it, the Fed may face a dilemma somewhere down the road of how to get out of the position it's in to prevent, you know, even more distortions in the financial markets. And, you know, I don't think anybody knows how they're going to do that, but the Fed does seem some distance away from normalizing interest rates at this point.
And the second part of this question, I guess, is it is a concern that increasing rates places a bigger burden
yes.
on the deficit.
Right.
Is that even a factor when they're considering whether they're going to raise or lower rates?
Well, it probably is. Obviously, a substantial increase in interest rates that would cause us to have to pay more interest on the debt would be a very negative. I mean, that would be a very, very bad deal. Right now, however, everybody's still buying our bonds. I think everybody has to keep that in mind. Currently, you know, everybody worries about China and Japan and various people around the world not buying our bonds. Well, they're still buying the bonds at roughly the same rate that they have been for the last decade. So, and we still own about 70% of our bonds ourselves. So, you know, that's something of a safety factor, I suppose. But it is, as Jeff mentioned earlier, a very unsustainable situation. You know, nobody really knows how this is going to play out over time. If you look at history and you talk to everybody in the financial industry about what might happen down the road, no one believes at this point that our debt and deficit problem will be solved without the threat of another crisis. you know, indicating that the politicians and the populace generally won't do anything unless threatened with Armageddon again. And, I mean, that's not a happy prospect, I guess, for any of us looking forward, but that's what the current belief is. Now, hopefully things don't work out that way and we get, you know, we get a better workout over time, but it's certainly something that we'll have to live with for a while.
All right, I'm going to ask one more question. I need a very short answer so we can wrap it up. The storms that affected the South this past week, resulting in a lot of damage and deaths, are these going to have any impact on the economy?
Not much. Measurably impact on Alabama, I suppose, since a lot of damage occurred in Alabama, but even Katrina was not a sizable impact on GDP for that year.
Great. Thank you, John.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for listening in to this month's installment of the Economic Update. We'll talk to you again next month. Thanks. Have a good day.